Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and this is a real treat. We're being joined by country legend Marty Stewart, who's coming to the Birchmere in Virginia for 2 days, October 30th and 31st. Hey, thanks so much for joining us, Marty.
Hi, Jason. Glad to be on your show. Glad to be here.
Man, it's been a wild year. A lot of venues around the country and even in our D area aren't even back open. We got a couple drive-ins and things like that, but the Birchmere is one of the few places you can still go see live music now. Where are you on your tour? How's this year been for you? Like, when did you get back out on the road?
Well, we're really not back out on the road, me and the band. We got sent home from the tour we were on back in March. It just kind of started falling apart and crumbling, you know, as everybody else did. So the buzz hasn't cranked since March. And so coming to the Birchmere will be the first time I've actually done a concert. Will not be with the Superlatives. It'll just be a solo show, which it's going to be honest. I'll give you that. But it's going to be wonderful to get out of town and play my guitar again. So I'm looking forward to coming back to the Birchmere.
For sure. Any teaser of, I don't want to spoil the set list, but, you know, can you give us a little teaser?
Man, I can tell you that from the bottom of my heart, we'll know more about it on Sunday morning after Friday and Saturday night, because I'm going to make it up as I go. And that's what I mean. It will be honest.
I love it. Now, the Birchmere, they've had a ton of legends move through there over the years. When you were growing up, you know, born in Mississippi in 58, who were your idols growing up when you were learning to play or first, you know, exposed to country?
Well, the first, you know, the Beatles were like, you know, just burning the world up at that time when I was first kind of tuning into music. But there was something about country music that I loved. And the truth of the matter is, the first two records I ever owned in my life was a Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs record and a Johnny Cash record. And the only two jobs that I ever had in my life for any length of time was with Lester Flatt and Johnny Cash. So those two guys, along with Bill Monroe and, you know, probably Merle Haggard, those were the people that really spoke to me as a kid and as a young musician. And as I grew up in life, they became my friends.
Not many people are lucky enough to say that, you know.
I know it, man.
Not only meet your childhood idols, but get to play with them and work alongside them. You sort of alluded to my next question, which is, you know, you got your start in the business touring with Lester Flatt, and then, you know, soon after Johnny Cash. What lessons did you learn from them? Were you just a sponge soaking up every second you were around them?
Well, I was a sponge. I mean, I hung on every word, and neither of those guys were like the kind of people that sit you down and go, now here's how you need to do this. I learned by observing and just seeing how they lived their lives and how they conducted business. But you mentioned the Birchmere, you know, just kind of being one of the only venues out there doing it. The Birchmere kind of has an oak tree kind of presence as far as venues out there. It's seen a lot of hard times. It's seen the best of times and tough times. Same with Lester Flatt and Johnny Cash. They were all kind of guys that they were always there. You know, they may not have a hit record this season, but it never really kind of mattered. They were just always a standard presence. And Lester taught me about longevity. His inspiration to me was not to come to Nashville and try to take it all down in 2 years' time and then be forgotten. It was about, his words were to be welcome every January the 1st. And that's a life lesson. And Johnny Cash, the thing I picked up off of JR, I called him JR more than anything, was he was fearless when it came to creativity. He was absolutely fearless. If he believed in a song or a concept or a tour or whatever he was doing, and nobody else believed it, never deterred him. He just went right ahead and took care of it and did it and paid the price if it didn't work and enjoyed it if it did. So being fearless, you know, if you're a creative individual, that is a mighty thing to have in your pocket. And so that I learned from John.
Wow, so you're learning the fearlessness from him and the longevity from Lester Flatt. I like what you said about, are you going to be welcome the next January 31st? Just keep it rolling. I love it.
That's so right.
you're sort of backing them and soaking up their, you know, lessons, their sage wisdom, and you finally break out on your own with your self-titled debut album in 85. How did you actually sign with Columbia? How'd that deal, first initial record deal, actually come about?
There was a song, Johnny Cash hadn't had a hit in a long time. And he did a television special, a Christmas special, a Johnny Cash Christmas special for the CBS television network called Johnny Cash and Montreux, I think it was called, Christmas in Montreux or something like that. And the guest on the show was Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and Kris Kristofferson. And after the show was finished filming, we'd go back to the hotel, and everybody would wind up in a hotel room passing the guitar around. And it was magical. And at that time, Willie and John didn't know each other very, very well. They had, you know, lightly casual friends. But their record producer, Chip Smoman, was there. He said, when we get back to Nashville, we need to do a Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash record. Everybody, well, oh, yeah, wonderful. So when we got back to town, we started the Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson record, and it really did not work. Their voices were so unique, but they just really didn't blend as two voices. So we cut songs for a couple of days, didn't amount to much. But I remembered how magical it was when the four of those guys would laugh and sing and pass the guitar around. So I called my cousin, Marty Gamblin, who ran Glenn Campbell's publishing company at that time. And Glenn Campbell had published a song, or recorded a song, actually, written by Jimmy Webb called The Highwayman. And I went over there and listened to it. I was kind of aware of the song. I'd been told about it. And there were four songs, four verses, no harmony required. And so I took that song to the studio and presented it, and they recorded The Highwayman. But the Columbia music executives knew all about that. And so on the strength of that, I think they said, what do you got in mind? You want to make a record? I went, sure. So I kind of stumbled into it that way. That's a long-winded answer, but that's how I got my first record deal.
You kidding me? I'm soaking it all up like you were with Lester Flatt. No such thing as long-winded. Okay, so then I know you jump over to MCA in 89 for your second album, Hillbilly Rock, and I think that's when you really, really started blowing up, at least my childhood, I remember hearing that album, and then the third, Touch Me, Turn Me On, Burn Me Down in 91. Like that is like some of the music of my childhood. But what are your memories of the jump to MCA and, how you think your sound had progressed from that early debut to that early 90s period? You were really taking off.
It just never really clicked at Columbia. I think it was probably my fault because I was, you know, trying for a direction that probably the world wasn't ready for at that time, and I probably wasn't ready for. But I, you know, lost my record deal, cooled off, regrouped, and came back, and it really became important to me to have a whole bunch of hits. Hit, 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 hit. That's all I cared about. And we hit a groove at MCA, me and the team, and Hillbilly Rock, and all those songs started coming. And I liked it. It gave me a excuse to get a bus and a band and some cowboy clothes and go up and down the road and play music that I loved and believed in. So that was a cool time in life. It really was.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, I'd be remiss. We can't go through all your hits, obviously, but I have to mention your Grammy-winning Travis Tritt duet, The Whiskey Ain't Working. Why do you think that was so magic between the two of you guys?
I don't know. I wrote the song with my buddy Ronnie Scaife, and we thought it would be a good song for Hank Williams Jr. And I was working on a record at that time called Tempted, and the album was finished, and we wrote the song too late to go on the Tempted album. I thought it was a hit, but I thought, let's put this on Bo Cephas' table. So we sent it to Hank Jr. He didn't particularly hear the song as a hit. So I was going to a Burger King drive-thru in Alabama one day on the road, and I heard this voice come on my radio, and it was singing a song called I'm a Member of the Country Club. I went, whoever that is singing, that's a good place for that whiskey song. And so I sent it to Travis Tritt's record producer. He liked it and recorded, and they invited me to come over and play on it and sing on it, and which I did, didn't think nothing else about it, and the song snuck up on us, and it became a hit. And when Travis and I met, it was like, man, we could have been raised three doors down from each other. I loved him, he's my brother, and that's how it is.
Oh, yeah, the Country Club's such a great song, too, but Whiskey Ain't Working's a jam, man. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, there was, to, sort of to your point about Flat's lesson of longevity, you know, you continued to, you've won Grammys in, like, multiple decades, you know, Same Old Train, Foggy Mountain Breakdown, Hummingbird, like, you keep winning them. I feel like every few years you turn into the Grammys and Marty Stewart's picking up another one, but what, you know, how satisfying is it to, you know, after Lester Flatt's advice, that you have been, can actually look back on your career and that sort of came true? You've been continually honored over the decades.
Well, I don't know. I can't explain it other than I get up and go to work every day. But I know the mission at hand now is not so much about, you know, racking up one more this or racking up one more accolade here or there, but it's about passing it on. It's about looking around, and when I see young songwriters or I see young artists, me and my wife Connie, we both are very tuned into how much young artists need encouragement. They need, you know, guidance, if asked. Anything we can do to help young artists to pass it along, and especially when it comes to traditional country music. It's a great thing to be able to hand it to somebody else, because we have to keep this thing going.
I love that. Yeah, but speaking of that, you know, before we run, you know, just sort of in closing, I had to compliment you on the Ken Burns.
Well, thank you.
You know, that was just an amazing piece of work.
Well, it's a life work. It was a labor of love for me. We worked on that show for like 8 years. But I love Ken Burns' work. He and his team are just the best of the best of the best. And once they're finished with the subject, it is done. And it is a part of American curriculum from then on. And he specializes in bringing to our attention, I say our as American people, stories and subject matter that we may not know or think too much about, but by the time he's through telling us about it, we understand how important it is to us and each other and as just our culture. And so I knew that when he was through with country music would have a whole lot more people that knew about it, was interested in it, and falling in love with it. So it was a win-win for everybody.
Now, do you have, speaking of that documentary, do you have something that you, either that your favorite sort of tribute that either you shared on there or something that you learned from watching it that you had no idea before?
I tell you what I learned on that show. My wife, Connie Smith, who came to my hometown to sing when I was a kid, she sang at the Choctaw Indian Fair in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And for years and years and years, I have told the story that on the way home from seeing her that night, I told my mother I was going to marry her. And I've told that I was 12 years old. So when we were fact-checking the Ken Burns show, they said an 11-year-old, you know, Marty Stewart went to see us. I said, guys, hold on, I think you're wrong. I think I was 12. They said, no, you were 11. And I had been telling it wrong all these years. They did the math, and they proved me wrong. That was one of the biggies that I learned on that show.
Well, I'm glad that they got it corrected for the record, for the curriculum, as you said.
Me so, too.
Awesome. Well, hey, we'll let you run. I know you're a busy man, but thanks for, you know, stopping in and spending a little time with us, and we look forward to you at the Birchmere on October 30th and 31st.
Jason, thanks for letting me be on your show. Have a great day. Stay safe.
All right, thanks.
Adios.